we're really happy to be here, and we're happy to see you again. For at least the last 10 years, I have always concluded our lecture circuit on an early Sunday in December here at Unity in New York. You have been a very sustaining community for me and for Christine, and we thank you for that. We have treasured Paul's ministry. We have been enriched by Britt's music and the other musicians, and we really love the message of unity, and particularly as that message is expressed here. I hope that you have a sense of what an important ministry this is that you do. The city of New York and this area needs the kind of life-affirming voice that Unity of New York puts out. So I thank you for that. I'm also glad to be here on Hanukkah. I think it's important that all Christians recognize that we are spiritual Semites, that the womb in which the Christian faith was born was a Jewish womb, and that Jesus was a Jew. His name was Yeshua. He was circumcised on the eighth day. He was presented on the 40th day. He was bar mitzvahed when he was 12, when his family took him up to Jerusalem. And he never departed from Judaism. I sometimes look at Christian history and see that what we spend a great deal of our time historically doing is spitting on the mother of the Christian faith. So I'm pleased to be here on Hanukkah and to acknowledge my indebtedness to this Jewish community. Now let me start in a strange place. When I was a kid, we used to sing a song about a Dutchman named Dunderbeck. Anybody ever heard of Dunderbeck? It seems that this Dutchman had a sausage-making machine. And the chorus of that song went like this: "Oh, Dunderbeck, oh, Dunderbeck, how could you be so mean? I'm sorry you invented such a terrible machine. The pussycats and bobtail rats will never more be seen because they'll all be ground to sausage meat in Dunderbeck's machine." Now, the reason I start with that story is that that when you're eating sausage, you have very little idea of the elements that went into it. You sort of accept it as a whole without making any distinguishing marks. And I think that the way most Christians relate to the Bible is quite similarly. We sort of have an homogenized view of the Bible, a sort of sausage view of the Bible, and we never bother to see its distinguishing parts that help to make it whole. There are a lot of Christians that assume that the Bible dropped from heaven fully written, divided into chapters and verses, and probably in the King James Version. As one lady is supposed to have said, "If the King James Version of English was good enough for Jesus, it should be good enough for you." And I don't think you'll ever understand the message of the Scriptures, and particularly the message of particular books of the Scriptures, until you separate them out and look at them in all of their uniqueness. What I want to do this morning is to look at one of the four Gospels in its particularity, separated from everything else. The reason I want to look at this particular book is that I've spent the last 5 years studying this book. And the work of that study was published last June by HarperCollins under the title "The Fourth Gospel, Tales of a Jewish Mystic." So let me lift John's gospel out of the Bible, out of the New Testament, and try to let it stand before you in all of its uniqueness. First, a couple of facts. The fourth gospel was the last gospel to be written. It did not make its appearance in human history until about the year 95 at the earliest, 100 at the latest. Now try to embrace what that means. That means that the fourth gospel, the one we call John, came into existence some 65 to 70 years after the crucifixion. That's 3 to 3.5 generations. It is not a current, contemporary eyewitness account. Second fact is that most scholars today do not believe that this gospel had a single author. The great debate in New Testament circles is not about who wrote John, but how many people wrote John. And the debate is between 3 and 5. And the book appears to have been written over a period of time, and it reflects different tensions going on in the life of the community. Now, what that means is it was not written by John Zebedee. That bit of propaganda is not supported by anyone I know in the New Testament world unless they go to Oral Roberts University or Liberty Baptist University. John Zebedee was a Galilean fisherman. In Galilee in the first century, not 1 out of 100 people could read, and not 1 out of 1,000 people could write. A Galilean fisherman who is described in the book of Acts as an unlearned man is not likely to have been able to write the fourth gospel in an exquisite Greek language that he did not speak. So John Zebedee is not the author of this book. And it's written 3 to 3.5 generations after the life of Jesus has come to an end. So let me take this gospel and lift it up for a moment and tell you some things about it that may well surprise you. First, there's no story of Jesus' birth in the fourth gospel. It's just not there. There are no shepherds, there are no wise men, there are no stars, there are no angels. There's no story of Jesus' birth in John's gospel. When Jesus appears, he is a grown human being. It's also interesting to me that the fourth gospel refers to Jesus on two occasions as being the son of Joseph. Once in chapter 1, once in chapter 6. That surprises people who've homogenized the story into a single narrative. The last gospel to be written did not think the birth of Jesus was sufficiently important to talk about it. A second fact. The mother of Jesus is never called Mary in the fourth gospel. She's simply called the mother of the Lord. And John reserves the title Mary for two people. One is Mary Magdalene, and the other is Mary, the sister of Martha. And there are some biblical scholars that think those two Marys are in fact the same person. So Mary Magdalene is the Mary in the fourth gospel. The mother of Jesus is never called by that name. Another interesting fact is John the Baptist is never called John the Baptist. And also John the Baptist does not baptize Jesus in the fourth gospel. He does in Mark, but he does not baptize him in John. He only bears witness to him. The idea that Jesus might have been baptized for the forgiveness of sins by John the Baptist was an idea that was anathema to the third generation of Christian people, so they simply dropped it out. There are no parables of Jesus in the fourth gospel. There are no single sayings. There's no Sermon on the Mount. In fact, when Jesus speaks in the fourth gospel, he speaks only in long, sometimes convoluted discourses, monologues and dialogues. Chapters 13, 14, 15, and 16 are called the farewell discourses, and Jesus constantly is speaking through all of those four chapters. No parables, no short sayings, no Sermon on the Mount, just long monologues and dialogues. An interesting thing that most people have no idea about. The miracles that occur in the earlier Gospels are not called miracles in the fourth Gospel. They're called signs. A miracle might be something you could look at and analyze. A sign is something that points beyond it to a different kind of meaning. John's Gospel is simply quite different. One other thing that I think it needs to be said about this Gospel is that it should not and cannot be read literally. A biblical fundamentalist would have a very hard time with the fourth Gospel. That's not what it's about. It's about interpreting the meaning of Jesus. And so the fourth Gospel spends some time laughing at, ridiculing those people who would read the stories literally. Let me pick three illustrations of that. In the third chapter, Jesus is having a conversation with a man named Nicodemus. It's in this conversation that the phrase "to be born again" enters the Christian story. It did not mean to have some evangelistic conversion experience where you go off and speak in tongues. It meant to have a new consciousness, a new birth of understanding. And in this conversation, Jesus says to Nicodemus, "Nicodemus, you'll never understand what I'm about until you are born again, born to a new consciousness." And Nicodemus is a literalist. He's a biblical fundamentalist. Nicodemus says, "Born again? How can I climb back up into my mother's womb so I can be born again? It doesn't make sense to a literal mind." In the next chapter, chapter 4, Jesus is having a conversation with a woman who is identified as a Samaritan by the well. And this conversation has to do with water. It begins when Jesus asks her to give him a drink. And after they begin to talk a while, Jesus says to the Samaritan woman, "If you knew who it was who is talking to you, you would ask me for water, and I would give you living water." And the Samaritan woman is a fundamentalist. She's a biblical literalist. So she looks at him and says, "Man, you don't even have a bucket. How are you going to get me any of this water?" Literalism is not the way you read this Gospel. The third occasion has to do with the disciples. The disciples have gone off and gotten some food. They're anxious that Jesus has not eaten for a while. So they bring him this food and they urge him to eat. Sort of like people do when they go into a grief situation. They urge the bereaved to eat. Got to keep up your strength. No, adrenaline takes care of that. You don't need to eat when you're in grief. The time will come when you can eat. You don't need to be pressured. The disciples were pressuring Jesus to eat. And Jesus said to them, "My friends, I have food of which you do not know." And the disciples are literalists. They say, "I wonder who brought him all that food." They don't get it. Religious people do not get it, because they think if it's not literally true, it cannot be true at all. And yet we understand in every area of life that literalism is not the doorway into truth. If I were to say to you that Paul is a big-hearted man, you would know what I meant. You wouldn't call 911 because he has an enlarged heart. You know that there's a difference between literal speaking and interpretive speaking. We do it all the time. If I were to ask you about one of the fairy tales or myths that you grew up with, how many of you really wonder about whether Little Red Riding Hood was a literal person of history? You know, we know that's a story. It's a story, and the reason it's such a repeated story in every generation is a story about a human experience. Little Red Riding Hood is about a young girl who comes into puberty. The Red Riding Hood is the symbol of her pubescence. And she's told that now that she has reached the age of puberty, she must stay on the straight and narrow path or the wolf will get her. How obvious do you have to be? But nobody goes around saying, "I wonder how that wolf ate up her grandmother." Or, "I wonder if Little Red Riding Hood was a person." We understand how to look at life non-literally in almost every area except in religion. But somehow we believe that if the Bible is not literally true, it cannot be true at all. And John's gospel is dedicated to helping people break that transition. And so he ridicules those who would take the text literally. Another interesting thing that the Jewish people did, when they wanted to say to their audience, now don't literalize this story, they had a technique for doing it. What we do in the Western world is if I were going to tell you something and I would want to make sure you knew it was a story, I would say, once upon a time, and then I would tell you, and then I would end the story with, and they lived happily ever after. And everybody knows that's a fairy tale. But the Jews didn't have that technique. So what they did was to exaggerate. They would exaggerate wildly. The story of Jonah and the great fish is a Jewish exaggeration story. Every Jew knew that that was not a literal fish and a literal man. There's no such thing as a fish that's able to swallow a man whole and have him live inside the belly of that fish for 3 days and three nights before the fish gets tired of him and throws him up. Everybody would know that that was a story with a truth embedded, but you would not literalize the story. John uses that exaggeration technique all the way through his gospel to tell us that you do not read these words literally. Let me illustrate that. John's gospel has a book within it from chapters 2 to 11 called the Book of Signs. Those are the miracle stories, and he tells you seven of them. And the first one is a story that's never been heard before in Christian history, which means it probably isn't literally true. But it's a familiar story. It's the story of Jesus turning water into wine at a wedding feast in Cana of Galilee. Now, if you read the story carefully, you discover that what Jesus does in this narrative is not just to change water into wine. He changes it into 160 gallons of wine. That ought to keep a wedding party going. And it's not just ordinary wine. It's not jug bottles with screw tops. It's Robert Mondavi or a Cote de Rhone. It's quality wine. The exaggerated figure is there. And the Jewish readers who would read that gospel, and they were the first readers, would understand that. You do not literalize this story. You keep reading the signs, and Jesus cures a man. He makes a lame man walk, but it's not just any kind of lameness. This man has been a cripple for 38 years. In the first century, life expectancy wasn't much longer than 38 years. So this man was a cripple all his life. It's an exaggerated story. You keep reading, and Jesus doesn't just give sight to the blind. He gives sight to a man who was born blind. And the text itself says, never before in human history has anything been done like this. And then you get to the final sign in chapter 11. And Jesus raises someone from the dead. But he doesn't just raise somebody from the dead in an ordinary way, if that can be ever ordinary. He raises from the dead some man who's been dead for 4 days. He's already buried. He's in his burial clothes. He's in his grave. The stone is placed over the tomb. And according to the text, the process of physical decay of his flesh has already begun. When Jesus walks out to the tomb of this man named Lazarus, his sister says, oh, Jesus, don't remove the stone. He's been dead 4 days. And the King James Bible says, quote, and already he stinketh, unquote. The Revised Standard Version changes that to say, already there's an odor. It's a little bit more discreet. This is an exaggerated story. All through the fourth gospel, you find Jesus using the technique of exaggeration, which the Jewish people would understand means that this is not to be looked at literally. And if you don't read that properly, you'll never understand the fourth gospel. Literalism is a plague of the Christian church. We have used literalism to justify every prejudice known to man. We have quoted a literal Bible to justify anti-Semitism, hating Muslims, diminishing women, enslaving people of color, segregating people of color, and bashing, tormenting, and persecuting gay and lesbian people. And we've done it all through history by quoting the literal text of a Bible that we called the Word of God. How can it be the Word of God if it issues in the destruction of humanity for any child of God? Let me get to the final thing about St. John's Gospel that I want to make sure people understand. In this Gospel, different from all of the rest, the resurrection is not the climax of the Jesus story. It's the crucifixion. The crucifixion. Jesus refers to the crucifixion as my hour. He rejoices to have the hour come. There's no dread in the fourth gospel about Jesus approaching his death. There's no scene in the Garden of Gethsemane where he prays that this cup might pass from him. He says instead, "Shall I not drink this cup? That is the purpose for which I was born. My crucifixion is the moment when people will understand who I am and who God is." Not the resurrection, the crucifixion. St. John's Gospel is not into that element of Christianity that we call atonement. Atonement. The idea that you and I are separated from God and some action has to be taken so that we will be made at one with God. That's what atonement means. It does not start out with the understanding that you are sinful, fallen, broken, inadequate, depraved human beings. But that's so much the message that we get from traditional Christian churches. You go into my church, the Episcopal Church, you can't come out feeling good about yourself because you've been told you are a miserable sinner, that there is no health in you, that you are not worthy even to gather up the crumbs under the Lord's table. We are taught in my church to approach God by saying, "Have mercy on me." What a strange thing to say to God, especially a God you understand as the source of life and the source of love. Quivering before this authority, begging for mercy. Oh, I think if you are an abused child standing before an abusive parent, that you might beg for mercy. I think if you're a convicted convict standing before a hanging judge, you might beg for mercy. But is the idea that a child of God standing before the source of our life has to beg for mercy? What a strange God. And it all comes back to an attitude that is not biblical, but it certainly has infected the Christian faith, that every human being is a fallen sinner. Original sin, we call it. Original sin is a distortion of our humanity. Original sin has got to go if the Christian faith is going to be recovered. We did not start in perfection and then fall into sin. We started as a single cell and we evolved into our humanity. We started as physical and we evolved into life. We took life and we evolved into consciousness. We took consciousness and we evolved into self-consciousness. The task of the Christian faith is not to go back and tell you how wretched, miserable, and sinful you are. It's to help you evolve into the fullness of what it means to be human. And you can't do that by telling people how evil they are. Can you imagine anybody that's ever been helped by being told how wretched and miserable and sinful they are? It just doesn't work that way. And John is the only gospel that seems to understand that. So John has the crucifixion be the climax of his story. Why the crucifixion? Because the crucifixion is the portrait of a human being who has become so whole and so free and so secure that he can give himself away in love to others no matter what they do to him. And that's the way John understands the crucifixion. The crucifixion is the time when people look upon a human being no longer driven by the will to survive. And they could see in that human being the presence and the face of God. Jesus says in the fourth gospel, and only in the fourth gospel, when I am lifted up, I will draw all people to myself. When I am lifted up on the cross, then people will know who God is. Because God is seen when we transcend the limits of our humanity and are free to give ourselves in love to another person. And that's why if you look at the New Testament from a John point of view, you will find that over and over again, it's not about rescuing people from their sins. It's about calling people beyond their boundaries into a new sense of what it means to be human. This is why Paul can write to the Galatians and say, once you are in Christ, there is no such thing as a human distinction. There is no Jew nor Greek. There is no male nor female. There is no bond or free. And we might add, there is no Protestant or Catholic. There is no Jew or Muslim. There is no gay or straight. There is no black or white. There's a common humanity. But if you're always trying to build yourself up by tearing someone else down, you will never discover that common humanity. John's gospel says that in the ability to give your life away, even at the cost of your death, you begin to reveal who God is and what God is. And so that's the essence of this gospel. And it's also the essence of the Jesus story. If I could take the Jesus story and bind it into a single sentence, it would be this: there is nothing any of you or I can ever do that places us outside the boundaries of the love of God. Nothing you can do, nothing you can be that places you outside the boundaries of the love of God. And that's the life that Jesus lives. He's betrayed and he loves the betrayer. He's denied and he loves the denier. He's forsaken and he loves those who forsake him. He's persecuted and tortured, and he's portrayed as loving his persecutors and his torturers. He is killed and he is portrayed as loving his killers. That's where God is seen. When you and I escape the boundaries of our fears and our insecurities and begin to give ourselves away in love to another, that is when God becomes present. And so to conclude this, the fourth gospel winds up having Jesus define his purpose. It's in the 10th chapter. Someone asked him, "What are you about, Jesus? Why did you come?" And they began to suppose various answers. "Did you come to make us religious?" Jesus says, "Oh no, there's enough religion in this world and most of it's evil. We kill people in the name of our God more often than we love people in the name of our God. No, I didn't come to make you religious." "Well, did you come, Jesus, to make us moral or righteous?" Jesus says, "No, I didn't come for that reason either. My experience with people who are very, very moral and very, very righteous is that they know a great deal about judgment. They know almost nothing about loving." "Well, Jesus, did you come that we might have the true faith, that we might be the orthodox believers and we could spend our time looking down on those whose faith is not quite as pure as ours? We can claim we are the one true church. We are the one true religion. No one comes to God except through my faith tradition," which is a claim religious people make all the time. Jesus says, "No, I didn't come for that purpose either. My experience with people who think that they have the true faith is that they always put their wagons in a circle and start shooting at everybody else." And then there's a note of desperation. The disciples say, well, why in the world did you come, Jesus? And then he gives the answer that John's gospel portrays as being revealed in the crucifixion. I have come, he said, that you might have life and that you might have it abundantly. I have come to call you into the fullness of your humanity. I've come to free you, to give your life away, to love you to the place where you can give your love away, to give you the courage to be yourself so deeply that you allow other people to be all that they can be. And that's what the essence of the Christian faith is. And I might add, that's the message that I think the Unity Church understands better than any other group within the Christian tradition. So look at the fourth gospel. Read the fourth gospel. Don't read it literally. Listen to the exaggeration. Listen to the power of love. And listen to the portrait of the crucified one who, in the moment when he gives his life away, reveals the human destiny and the meaning of God. Amen.
We're so glad you did not retire from teaching, from speaking, from writing. You're a blessing. Thank you so much. Okay, let's break up into groups and discuss what we just heard. Instead, let's turn within and let Spirit reveal to us the message that we came by divine appointment to hear. We begin with our meditation song, I Am So Blessed. The words are in your bulletin if you need them. I am so blessed for all that I have, all that I am, and all that God is. Take a deep breath, close your eyes. Let the chair support your weight. Relax, let go. Feel the power, the strength, the light of Spirit at work in you right now. Peace be still and know that I am God. It's in the Gospel of John that we find the I am statements. I am the way, the truth, the life. I am the vine. Jesus wasn't speaking from his personality. He was speaking at depth from the Christ being that we all are. I am is the name of Spirit within you. I am. What did you say today about who you are? I am always sick, always broke. I am. We limit the power of God to move through us when we put a limitation on who we are. I am a child of God. I am creative. I am whole and well. I am abundantly blessed. I am loved, and I am loving. These are the words that bring the power of God into our lives, into the body, into every area of living life on this planet. In the quiet of your being, I invite you to take these words into your heart. I am whole and well. Let those words take hold in any part of your being that is going through pain right now. Breathe the wonderful healing light and love of God into your heart, into your joints, into anywhere that you're feeling discomfort. Let that God energy take hold as we know I am whole and well. If you're going through any kind of confusion today about steps to take in your life or choices to be made, I invite you to know I am filled with the light of God. I am guided perfectly to my highest and best. I am filled with the light of God. I am guided perfectly to my highest and best. When we let go and let Spirit direct us, we will know what to do and how to do it. We'll know what to say and how to say it and when to remain silent. Breathe that truth in. I am the light of the world is the truth of every child of God. I am creative. I am prosperous. I am loved. And I am loving. And as our friend Bishop Spong says, I love wastefully. I let it flow forth abundantly, and abundant love returns. We cannot give enough love away. So in the quiet of your being, in the silence, just for a few moments, allow that I am to take hold. I am the love of God in action on the planet. Be still and know I am God.